You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Well, right now, an opportunity to get behind the curtain with the next Premier of Ontario, quite possibly. And finally, a chance to ask the man himself about his proposed funding for faith-based schools. I'm quite looking forward to this conversation with the one and only Mr. John Tory. Thank you for your time.
Pleasure.
I know you're busy, absolutely busy.
Always time for you.
5 hours of sleep a night, I bet.
Five and a half. An extra half hour can make a difference, especially when it's dark when you wake up in the morning.
Yeah. Don Valley West.
Yep.
Home turf.
Yes, and
yep.
I'm 53 years old. I've spent 48 years of my life in Don Valley West. We raised our own kids there, and I grew up there and went to church and Cubs and school, public school and all the rest. So when I decided to run in Toronto, which was a decision I had to make as a means of showing leadership and renewing the party here, it was an easy decision as to which riding, just because that's the one I've spent most of my life in.
Son of John A. Tory.
Correct.
President of Thompson Investments Limited.
Yes.
And director of Rogers Communication.
He's 77 years young and still goes to work every day. My wife considers this a bad precedent.
She was hoping for a second run, wasn't she?
Well, she was hoping that I would sort of retire at some reasonable age, and she looked at my father and says, there's not much hope with
not
this.
Not much hope. No. My son is constantly reminding me that we were much harder on him than his younger sister. And with you being the eldest of four, did you find that to be the case?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, people think this business of being the eldest is a sort of guarantee that you're going to get, you know, the special treatment and the first one always gets everything better and so on. My youngest brother had the easiest time ever, and I can tell you, we were a little bit the same with our fourth. We have four kids, my wife and I, and the youngest, you know, I think he was the last one left home, and I don't know, I don't think we sort of slacked off in terms of being good parents, but we just certainly sort of, he'd be horrified to hear me say this, but we babied him, you know, which meant that when he asked for stuff, we generally gave it to him. So, you know, yes, the answer is yes and yes.
Got it. Who did you kind of cause a ruckus with the most growing up? Jennifer, Jeffrey, Michael?
My two brothers were a bit younger than me, and so they tended to fight with each other.
Right.
And they sort of left me alone because I was a bit older. So to the extent I had limited encounters of that kind, it was probably with my sister. But, you know, we love each other today. We're all four of us are good friends. And I didn't really have much because that may be one area where, because I was the oldest, I was much less involved in any kind of that family conflict.
Yeah.
They tended to leave me alone. So that was probably a good thing.
Nice. Lawrence Park Community Church.
Yep. That's part of the United Church.
I was talking to you briefly a couple of weeks ago, and you made the comment that, you know, you've been to church more these days than back in the day, because you're just out visiting and touring and meetings, and of course with this faith-based funding scenario coming out. What was church like growing up for you?
Well, I mean, it was something we did from a very young age. I can't even recall how young I was when I started to go to Sunday school, probably, you know, five or something. And
sure.
We went every week, and we went every week through until confirmation, which took place, I think, at 15. And, you know, I have a lot of memories and friendships of people that I also did other things in the neighborhood with, you know, whether it was Cub Scouts or this or that.
Hmm.
But I have, you know, friendships today that are people that I went to Sunday school with. And to be candid, I guess not unlike many other sort of teenagers in some faiths, including the United Church, trying to think of the right word now, the role that kind of church-going religion played in my life started to diminish after that, and I
sure.
think it diminished, to be candid, entirely when I went to university, because, you know, it wasn't part of what I was doing. And it's very interesting, and I did say this to you, that since I've been in public life, you know, I now go to church several times a week, but it's different kinds of churches, but I find it's been very, very enriching and educating for me, because what I found more than anything else, I've learned about other people's faiths and how they practice their faiths and so on. I've seen the degree to which in many of the faiths that I could refer to, it's very much a family thing, which I think is a big plus, but more than anything else what I've seen is the common values that are shared by people of all faiths. They have different books. We have the Koran and the Torah and the Bible and so on, and we have you know, all different days people worship and different times of day they worship and all the rest. But when you boil it down and you go to the mosque or the synagogue or the gurdwara or the church and you listen to what's being said at the front and the values that are being you know, that are being discussed as among those people of that faith, there's so much people have in common, and it's gratifying on the one hand because you recognize that. On the other hand, it kind of troubles you because you say, well, how come then, you know, we have as much, you know, conflict in different places that seemingly is based on religion? Because you sort of say, well, you almost can't imagine it's possible because the values are so much the same.
Boy, you know what? You think back in your life, John, I mean, seriously, you've come a long way from that apartment on Glen Forest Road.
you do know. You know, I remember when I saw you, I was you said a couple of things you knew about me, and I went home and told my wife. Actually, I said, you know, I met this man, and I told him her about your background. And I said he said a couple of things to me that he knew about Glen Forest Road and something else. And I'm sort of thinking, I said, how do you know that? And I think you said to me, that's just in my line of work.
It's my job.
That's my job.
What kind of a kid were you, John? I mean, growing up, did you ever get into any trouble?
Nothing serious.
No.
Nothing serious, but yes, I got into all the kind of, you know, usual scrape-ups that kids get into, but, you know, those, I look at that, fortunately, I had a sense of perspective about that when I became a father, because you come to realize that when your own kids get into those kind of scrape-ups of one kind or another, they're part of growing up, and yeah, as long as you can contain them to being sort of the usual scrape-ups, that's what you hope for.
Look, you only had to walk, what, 4 blocks to school, Snowden Avenue, down to Bedford Park,
yep,
and you never threw any rocks at windows or,
oh,
you know, beat up any kids? Or...
I'll confess to having thrown snowballs at cars, and we thought we were very smart, and we'd hide behind a fence and throw snowballs at cars. And then, of course, the worst moment of horror was when the driver would actually pull over and start walking back to where the kids were throwing the snowballs.
Those brake lights.
Yeah, and we thought, yeah, exactly. Those brake lights were a horrifying sight. But we thought we were pretty smart until the brake lights came on, and then we started thinking, oh, no, what do we do now? So we did a few things like that, but nothing that ever caused any real harm.
But, you know, you and Stephen Harper both seemed like you were sort of golden boys. You know, smart, honor roll, chess club. You followed Daddy in the same vocation.
But wait a minute.
Right?
For example, and I've not ever been afraid to say this because I often use it as an example for kids.
Yeah.
I went to summer school in grade 10 because I failed one subject in grade 10.
Oh, did you?
Sure. And I mean, you know, look, I can tell you it was a great learning experience for me because, you know, when you sit in a classroom and it's about 104 degrees and there's no air conditioning and you're sitting there taking a subject over again and you realize it was only because of your own sort of laziness that you didn't do well. But it also, I do talk about it now because I often will say to kids, look, you know, I did that, and it probably was just that I wasn't paying attention, but the bottom line was that after that, I became, then I was an honor roll student after that all the time.
Yeah.
And I think it was just part of maybe, you know, learning about discipline and accountability. But, you know, yes, if you said if I had a pretty, you know, normal sort of life without too many potholes, certainly compared to people I see now in the neighborhoods. You know, when I go to all the troubled neighborhoods in Toronto and London and Ottawa and so on, you see how a lot of these kids have to sort of start their lives as teenagers, their kind of mature lives, behind, you know, quite a few eight balls.
Yeah, they're starting in a deficit.
Yeah, and so it's one of the reasons why I've devoted a lot of the passion I have in politics to helping those kids and their families because, I mean, those are bright kids. There's nothing wrong with their brains. There's nothing wrong with their abilities. It's really just they need a bit of a hand up that perhaps I didn't need because I didn't have too many potholes along the way.
Who's had the greatest impact on John Tory's life?
Aside from family, I mean, because obviously I've been married now for almost 30 years and my wife is a huge influence on me. I say in some of my speeches when she's with me sometimes that when you're in this kind of a job, which can be quite lonely, that you go home to someone who provides you with both unvarnished advice and unconditional love, both of which are extremely important.
Yes.
But my father, of course, and my mother have been huge influences. But outside of family, I name two people usually who I met in different parts of my life, one of whom was Ted Rogers, who I ended up working for. But I met him as quite a young man, and we really met and became friends when I was young because he had a fascination with politics. He'd been a young conservative when he was like 14 or 15, and I became...
Just like you.
Yeah, exactly. And so we became friends for that reason. And then the second person, who became a very close personal friend of mine, although he started as someone that I sort of viewed and still do as an icon, is Bill Davis. And Bill Davis was a man, when I became a young PC at 14, that was just becoming premier almost that year, the next year. And we've become very close friends, and he's a person who's been a mentor to me. So those two people beyond family have been very, very important to me.
You and Barbara have 4 grown children.
We do. We have a son who's 28, who's married, and
John,
expecting our first grandchild, John,
right,
his wife, Melanie. And then we have Christopher, who's a music student at Berklee College. And then we have... Susan, who is just returning to her second year of medical school, and George, who is allegedly studying at Dalhousie as we speak, although there's a lot of partying that goes on down there, but that's fine. He did well in his first year, so I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Studying over at Berklee, you know, Livingston Taylor, the brother of James Taylor, teaches there. Livingston was on our show last year, and
my son is there, and he's just enjoying. He's in his fourth year, so
you don't have twins in the family, though.
We do not,
because your father is a twin.
He was. He is. And he and his twin brother,
Uncle James.
Yes, he went through school with his brother. It's one of those stories where they went to school every single day from age 4 right through law school and practiced law together for 20 years and are still best friends. It's a nice story, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
President and CEO of Rogers Media, then 4 years later of Rogers Cable, served as volunteer chairman of the Canadian Football League for 9 years, including 4 as league commissioner, and married almost 30 years to Barbara Hackett. Which was harder?
Oh, Well, they were all different. I mean, you know, work is work, and my volunteer work, including the CFL, was something you did as a passion. But, you know, I think marriage is a joy, but it is something I think anybody listening that's being honest, you have to work at. I mean, you have to... And we have a wonderful marriage, and Barb has been particularly indulgent of my crazy pursuits in politics because, you know, it's a lifestyle that is very different, and she has to be a part of it. You can't do it alone. So I think the one that where you have to work, just because I think any two people do to make a success of your marriage, is the marriage. And being parents is a big responsibility. I said yesterday at a press conference I gave that, you know, I think a lot of the problems we have today are because maybe parents have found it easy to delegate their responsibility subconsciously to teachers and police officers,
well
and
said.
Social workers.
Well
and,
said.
And, you know, so that's a big assignment. So, you know, if you said, what's the one where you really have to work the hardest, not because it's a drudgery, but because you have to work hard to get the joy, it's the marriage. And the parenting and so on that go with it.
How did you and Barbara meet? It was York University, but it was like across a crowded room. You gazed upon each other's eyes.
Oh, no, it was better than that. Well, I mean, well, no, it's not quite that good. That sounds like the stuff that movies are made of. But we both took a French course, and she showed up with her fiancé to the French course.
Oh,
and
you
I showed
moved
up with
in.
My girlfriend. And we both decided independently. We didn't even know each other, of course. We decided independently, well, it just wouldn't look good if you showed up with your fiancé or girlfriend to sit next to each other.
No, no.
So we'd both go and sit somewhere else in the class. So lo and behold, we both took seats in the front row next to each other. Now, she claims, and it's in the Ottawa Citizen today, this is one of her stories that I think are sort of slightly fictional, but
yes.
She claims I turned to her because I was David Crombie's campaign manager when he was mayor of Toronto at the time and said to her, what ward do you live in? As if this was an important fact I should determine.
That's a pickup line.
Well, that's what she said was the worst one she'd ever heard. And I simply point out to her that less than a year later we were married, which is the way the Ottawa Citizen story ends today. That notwithstanding my clumsy, you know, ridiculous pickup line,
funny.
As you call it, that I was married to her a year later. So, you know, her fiancé was gone from the scene, and so was my girlfriend.
I sincerely hope that what you do in public life does not have any detriment on your marriage. And it sounds like you've already admitted to the fact that, we have to work on our marriages. We really do. But you... you know, John Tory, the public life, the campaign trail, and all the hours and everything you're giving to so many other people. I hope you're reserving enough for your wife.
Well, you know how we do it. Well, it's hard because we had a sort of agreement when I became the leader that she would get one night a week she could sort of work with my scheduling team to take for herself, and I wasn't necessarily totally honoring that. But the great part about the campaign, which we're about to be in on Monday, is that she's with me. I mean, she's been with me all this week on the bus, and I said to her this week, and I'm sharing an intimate conversation, but I don't mind, because I said to her, she sits across the table from me. These buses, what they do for the listener's benefit, they configure them so there's kind of an office setting in the back where I can sit and work while we're traveling from place to place working on speeches and so on, and she sits in a chair right across from me across the desk. And I said to her, you know, just having you sitting there, and so that when I look up from working on my speech, because I am working a lot of the time, it just makes me feel good. Because, you know, these jobs are unusual, and there's stressful times in them, and, you know, just to have her there is a great sense of comfort to me, and we're together, so that's great.
John Tory, leader of the Ontario Progressive Conservative Party, if your proposed policy of funding religious schools here in Ontario only represents a quarter of a page in a 52-page document, why has it dominated the news?
I think because people misunderstand it. I mean, I think people, you know, people are a bit afraid of change sometimes, and people are a bit afraid of things they don't know that much about, and that's my fault, partly, because, you know, my job is to go out and make sure I can communicate as effectively as I can what this policy is about and why I'm putting it forward. And I'm putting it forward for two principal reasons. Number one, I want kids... from the 53,000 kids that are in faith-based schools today, all different faiths, of course, many of them Christian, but there are many others, I want them to feel very much a part of public education and to be included in public education. I think we're going to be better off if those students are included in a broader, more diverse public education. I think that it means we will be able to make sure, you know, without any doubt, that those kids are receiving... an education that is consistent with the curriculum we adopt in Ontario and having fully qualified teachers teach it, and that the schools will be inspected as appropriate, as our public schools are. And so that's number one. And number two, of course, is that we have had throughout the history of Ontario, and since before Confederation, 150 years, we've had faith-based schools, namely Roman Catholic, that have been publicly funded. And so I have to tell you, it's a bit difficult when you meet someone who's Hindu or Greek Orthodox or Christian, and they look at you and say, well, now, could you explain to me why it is that the Catholic schools get funded and ours don't? And when you look at them and say, well, that's just history, they don't tend to be satisfied with that answer.
No.
You know, because it's unfair. The United Nations has twice found it to be discriminatory. And I point out to people as well, and this is something most people don't know, and again, I've got to keep communicating this so they do find out, that this Ontario, if we did this, would become the seventh province or territory in Canada to do it.
Yeah, this isn't exactly a new concept here in Canada.
No, I mean, in BC, this is pretty basic stuff. They funded faith-based schools for years, and I would point out, you know, to those, there are those who worry that, oh my goodness, if we do this, every student will flock from the public school system immediately into some sort of a faith-based school. Well,
come on.
In BC, where they've done it for decades, the level of enrollment in these schools is actually lower than in Ontario. So, you know, that proves that point is wrong.
Hmm.
So I just say that it's a matter of both inclusiveness of public education and it's a matter of fairness. And for me, those are two matters of principle, and I will happily fight for things on principle and stand on those and explain those to people, because I think that's what you're in public life to do.
But, John, for those who are disturbed that their tax dollars would fund stuff like creationism or abstinence, you know, that sort of a scene, how much will it actually cost to fund the religious schools?
Well, it will cost, if you know, cost based on our best estimates, $400 million a year. Now, people will say that's a lot of money, and I agree. That's out of an education budget of $13.1 billion, I think is the number this year.
That puts it in perspective.
Yes, and we've also pledged, for example, to invest $963 million additional dollars this year in public education, rising to $2.4 billion by the end of our mandate if we're elected. So if you look at these figures all in context, I admit the fact that that's a lot of money, $400 million, but if you achieve inclusiveness in public education and if you achieve fairness, and let me point out one other thing that many of your listeners will know, but I think, again, it's worth mentioning. The parents of the kids in the faith-based schools all pay their taxes at present to the government. The government spends that money on education, educating other people's children, because, of course, the students in the faith-based schools are not there.
Yep.
If all those kids showed up tomorrow morning because the schools were all closed, the faith-based schools, in the public system, there would be a huge additional cost to educating those children. It wouldn't be free, because the school boards are spending the money now put in by the parents who don't send their kids to public school. So I just think we have to look at all these things in a reasonable and kind of rational way, but the most important thing to look at, most important thing, is that this is going to include kids who are presently not included in public education, which I think is good, and it's going to address a fairness issue that has existed for decades.
All right, so quick specific questions, and we'll let you go.
Yep.
And these answers, I can already imagine the answers.
Yep.
Here's the answers you're going to say. We won't know until Bill Davis and his committee finish the research, but here's the questions anyway.
Yes.
Would the religious schools be required to have open enrollments?
Well, I think there'd probably be the same rules, and again, Mr. Davis will be asked to consider this, but if you ask me, is it likely that we'd be looking for something consistent with the Catholic schools, where I think the rule is, if there's a space, and if you sign up for the whole program, because what you can't do is say, okay, there's a space, but I'm only going to come for sort of 4 hours of the day, and I'm going to accept myself from, you know, 8/10 of the program. I think the rule, as applies to the Catholic schools when they were fully funded, is there has to be a space, and that you have to sign up for the whole program. And I think that you'd be looking probably for consistent rules. Why would you try to find different ones?
Well, do you realize that some Christian schools require that at least one parent is a Christian?
I think that the Catholic schools traditionally have required, I think, the same thing. But I think that the rule nonetheless said if there was a space that was left open because there wasn't a spot, there was a spot left over after all the Catholic parents had applied, that they would nonetheless make it available. So, look, these are the kinds of things you correctly identified that Mr. Davis will look at, and we'll look first to the other provinces and see what they've done.
If the religious schools must teach the Ontario curriculum, then how would that affect the school's ability to give specific teachings on spiritual and moral matters, especially if those matters are contrary to accepted public beliefs and morality?
Well, the bottom line is that two things. Number one, that when it comes to things like science curriculum, I mean, the science curriculum is the science curriculum, and it's going to be taught, and that's a condition. And if people don't like that, then they don't have to take the money. But number two, I've also gone on to say that, you know, when you talk about things like accepted morality or whatever, my major concern is that we're going to have absolute and complete respect for things like the Human Rights Code, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, inability on anybody's part to teach hate, not that I'm suggesting people would, but I'm just saying those are things that I, as Premier, in any event, regardless of this policy or not, would be very vigilant in saying that's the way that we operate in this country, those are the rules we follow, and that we're not going to see those rules violated in these schools or any other place.
Final one, will faith-based schools retain the right to select faith-sharing staff or even reject the application of a potential applicant based on things like sexual orientation?
I can answer that question, but again, you know, the Human Rights Code of Ontario says you shall not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. And I tell you, it may not make some people happy to hear this, but that is the law of the land. And under a John Tory premiership and a progressive conservative government with any policy at all to do with education or not, even if I wasn't talking to you about this policy, I would say to you, we are not not allowed in this country to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or a host of other things, skin color, nationality, I forget, age. You're not allowed to discriminate. That's the law, and that's a law that I will be passionate about upholding.
I really appreciate your time. I think you're... I think you've got a lot of guts for opening this issue up. Look, the most of us sit around here and go, we realize it's unfair. I mean, the UN has recognized that the Supreme Court of Canada has said, no, it's not a reality. Ontario has the right to be able to do what they want to do in this particular situation. So that shows you what color the sky is the world in with the Supreme Court. But, yeah, I mean, the rest of us people rationally look at this and go, it is an unfair system at present. What are we going to do to change it? I admire you so much for taking this on.
Got to have courage. What else would you be in public life for except to have some courage and some passion about things you care about, and there's too few people who just come in and say all the right things to get themselves elected, and then frankly you don't even do those things. And,
yeah, we've heard that before.
Yeah, so I'm not there to do that. I'm here to make a contribution for a period of time. I don't want to become a career politician. I want to make a difference and then leave and make room for somebody else. Maybe you could run.
Yeah, not a chance, but
all
I
right.
Like your style.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Mr. Torrey. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
John Torrey on the Drew Marshall Show. Boy, you better listen quick. He moves through it. I like his style. Lead, follower, get the heck out of the way. That's what it comes down to. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back just to say goodbye to you. Let you know what's on next week. Stay with us.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.